The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the double September-October 2022 issue. We begin with our cover story, Who Were the Vikings? Today's popular notions of Norse seafarers hardly touch the surface of their true identity or their influence around the world and across the centuries. Marauders, brutes, barbarians. The fabled Viking people, or Norsemen, have long been portrayed as cruel warriors whose way of life included little more than pillaging and plundering. To be fair, they did engage in plenty of raiding. From AD 800 to the 11th century, many Scandinavians departed what we now know as Norway, Sweden, and Denmark in search of riches. Throughout much of Europe and as far as modern-day Russia, Iceland, and North America, the nomadic sailors engaged in trade, exploration, and war. But the Vikings also spent extended periods in foreign locales, leaving lasting marks of a rich culture that modern depictions often overlook. The Norsemen take on North America. Vinland, or the land of wine, isn't listed on any modern map. 1,000 years ago, however, it served as the stage for a seminal moment in world history. Icelandic sagas record it as the place where, 500 years before Christopher Columbus ever sailed a ship, the Vikings became the first Europeans to set foot in the so-called New World, even building a short-lived settlement. By the late 1980s, these Norse seafarers had already established colonies in Iceland, Greenland, and the Atlantic stepping stones that brought them within the range of the Canadian coast. From there, according to the oral reports of the time, written down 2 centuries later in The Saga of the Greenlanders and The Saga of Eric the Red, the Vikings stumbled upon North America around AD 1000. Over the next few decades, they made several expeditions to this new-to-them world. They built homes, harvested resources, traded, and clashed with the native peoples. Then, as quickly as they arrived, they abandoned Vinland. The two accounts often differ. In the Saga of the Greenlanders, after the accidental sighting of unknown western lands, Leif Erikson explores 3 distinct regions at Canada. Helluland, or Land of Flat Stones, which was probably the barren Baffin Island, Markland, or Land of Forests, which was likely located along the Labrador coast, and Vinland, a warm region in what is now the province of Newfoundland, where Erikson and a small crew wintered. In the Saga of Eric the Red, Erikson is portrayed as the accidental discoverer of Vinland, and an Icelandic merchant named Thorfinn Karlsefni as his explorer. Details aside, we now know these tales are at least broadly true. The Vikings did venture to North America in roughly the timeline the sagas describe, becoming the first people to bridge the world's oldest cultural divide. For centuries, scholars lumped Vinland together with other fabled realms, like Atlantis or Avalon. But archaeologists kept looking, and the search paid off in 1960, when Anne Stein Ingstad and Helge Ingstad of Norway excavated a series of earthen structures located on Newfoundland's northern edge, near the entrance to the Gulf of St. Lawrence. The site, Landsaumeadow, proved to be of Norse origin. To date, it's the only verified Viking settlement on the continent. It consists of 8 timber frame buildings with thick walls of sod, built in the same style as Viking settlements in Greenland and Iceland. Some were dwellings, others forges and workshops. The digs uncovered evidence of iron production and ship repair, among other activities. Experts estimate that this cluster of homes and workshops would have supported 70 to 90 people year-round, and likely took at least 2 months to construct. Birgitta Wallace, a Swedish-Canadian archaeologist who worked with the Ingstads and conducted further excavations for Parks Canada in the late 1970s, is careful to note that there's more to Vinland than this outpost. Many people make the mistake of thinking that Vinland is just a point on the map, she says, but it's a land, the same as Greenland or Iceland. It means a big area. The first part of the word explains why this vast area so enticed the Vikings. It was flush with wild grapes, the key ingredient in wine, which didn't grow anywhere near their desolate homeland. A chieftain's power in Norse society was based primarily on how he could show off and be very impressive, Wallace says. Having wine would impress the hell out of anybody because it was so rare. According to the saga of the Greenlanders, Ericsson loaded his ship with grapes during his first voyage. He and his followers were also drawn to the timber, since Greenland has virtually no trees. Given the long-term architecture at Lonsdale Meadows and the bounty surrounding it, Wallace says, I think this was a place they intended to use for a long time, but according to the archaeological evidence, they didn't. That too fits with the sagas. The Vikings seem to have stayed at Lonsdale Meadow for a few decades at most, then returned to Greenland. For such a hardy culture that was capable of surviving the harsh northern climate, it may seem strange that they failed in this relatively hospitable place. But experts have a few hypotheses to explain this. One theory claims that they were simply driven out by the native peoples, whom they've called Skraelings, a problem they never faced in uninhabited Greenland and Iceland. Indeed, this is the reason given by the saga of Eric the Red. Though trade between the two groups began amicably, the situation quickly devolved, and it seems the Vikings more or less fled in a great shower of missiles. After a deadly skirmish with the natives, the saga states they were now of the opinion that though the land might be choice and good, there would always be war and terror overhanging them from those who dwelt before them. Of all the artifacts at Lonsdale Meadow, only one may speak to the relations between Vikings and Native Americans, a single arrowhead lodged in the wall of a house. Of course, it's impossible to say whether it arrived there directly via bow or whether it had already existed within a piece of sod the Vikings used in the building of the house. More likely, a combination of factors forced the Vikings to sail back from whence they came. Wallace notes that their home base in Greenland was meager itself, and it may have been unsustainable to use a far-flung colony of just a few hundred to populate an even farther-flung colony. Climactic evidence has suggested that their retreat also coincided with a cold snap and likely an advance of sea ice, making it difficult to travel between Greenland and Vinland. Meanwhile, lake sediment samples collected near a former Norse farm hint that droughts prompted their sudden departure, according to a March 2022 Science Advances study. Either way, they were gathering resources from a location nearly as far away from Greenland as Greenland was from Europe, their main source of trade. Without the advantage of proximity, why reinvent the supply chain? Lonsdale Meadow, the only proof we've discovered that Vikings reached North America, matches the description of Strömfjord, the year-round settlement that, according to the saga of Eric the Red, the Vikings used as a launching point for deeper journeys into Vinland. But if the saga rings true, and there's no reason to think it doesn't, broadly speaking, the Vikings built a second settlement, and it remains undiscovered. Hope was a seasonal site located farther south, where the Vikings collected timber and grapes in the summer. Archaeologists have found no sign of it, but the sagas offer a few clues. Besides grapes, it was rich in salmon, and the natives made boats of animal hide. Based on those criteria, Wallace is confident Hope was somewhere in modern-day eastern New Brunswick, likely in the area around Miramichi and Cowler Bay. It's the northernmost extent of the wild grape range, along with the butternut trees, whose wood has been found at Lonsdale Meadow. Other researchers have proposed locations along the Atlantic seaboard, as far south as Maine, Boston, and New York. But wherever Hope once stood, Wallace doubts any trace remains. As a light temporary settlement, it likely wasn't sturdy enough to be detectable centuries later. In 2016, Sarah Parkak, a University of Alabama archaeologist who uses satellite imagery to locate buried structures, discovered what seemed like a promising lead at Point Rosie on the southwest end of Newfoundland. While digging, her team found iron, but it turned out to be the kind that develops naturally in bogs, rather than being smelted. Since then, the search hasn't brought any progress. So, Wallace argues, hope may continue to elude us. I think it would be extremely hard to find any kind of physical evidence, she says, and that's a pity, but I certainly wouldn't pay for an excavation. Nevertheless, archaeologists, amateur and professional, are on the lookout, especially in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. And whatever future searches do or don't reveal about the Norse in North America, one thing is certain. People love Vikings, Wallace says, adding that the subject is still ripe for research. 50 years after she began work at Lonsdale Meadow, she still keeps up on all the latest scholarly articles. Every day I find one that is absolutely worth reading. The lowdown on Viking garb. Movies and TV shows have popularized the view of Scandinavia's Vikings as grimy combatants. In the 1999 film The 13th Warrior, for example, you will find plenty who look like they could use a bath. The stereotype of grubby Vikings and the movie's plot stems from an account by Arab traveler Ahmad ibn Fadlan, who may have exaggerated the dirty appearance of Swedish Vikings to entertain readers. And the pagan warriors' attacks on Christian monasteries no doubt cemented their barbarous reputation. Meanwhile, screen depictions like Netflix's The Last Kingdom series have gone too far in the other direction and overstate the opulence of the Vikings with highly decorated costumes. In reality, most Vikings were Middle Ages farmers who wore simple, durable clothing, says Ulla Mannering, an archaeologist who researches Northern European textiles and costumes at the National Museum of Denmark. And while a select few enjoyed more ritzy lifestyles and engaged in ferocious battles and exciting trains abroad, even their appearances would seem fairly plain to today's audiences. I don't think the Viking Age or prehistory itself was particularly fancy, Mannering says. It would probably not satisfy our modern eye. Here's what we know and don't about Norsemen clothing, grooming, and accessories. While costumes may look extravagant on screen, they don't always align with historical evidence. Most knowledge of Viking clothing comes from decayed, fragmented samples found in graves and bogs, but researchers do have a general sense of their style. Composed mostly of flax and wool, the clothing likely involved very basic shapes. Hollywood has made the mistake of including modern-looking knitwear, while recovered garments are far coarser than today's weavings. Unlike current fashion, these pieces were built to last. Garments were probably passed down from high-class wearers to lower-class counterparts, Mannering says, or they were simply stolen and repurposed. Most women stuck to thick, strap-style dresses, topped with a sturdy cloak. Men liked to layer too, often with a long tunic and trousers under cloaks. This was helpful when heat sources were scarce, Mannering says, and a layer of breathable linen under wool provided warmth while preventing excessive sweating. As for footwear, Vikings may have donned leather boots that were fairly easy to manufacture, but it isn't clear how often they actually wore these shoes, which may have been quite slippery on the grass and dirt. The modest look held up regardless of class, as proven by a recent garment reconstruction from two 10th century high-class individuals' graves in Denmark. The embroidery in these findings were highly unusual. Mannering says, even for expensive clothing, it might have been recycled from a wall hanging. Overall, be wary when shows like History Channel's Vikings suggest that the most affluent Vikings strutted around with detailed stitching and tight, complex clothing patterns. The Scandinavians applied fine craftsmanship to their coats and cloaks, some of which were made of furs hunted from far northern regions and were considered lavish. There's a clash in visuals because we have an idea that if you're a tough Viking, you will look even tougher with a skin thrown over your shoulder, Mannering says. But Vikings, with the capacity of wearing a real fur garment, would never have just made a half item like that. Unfortunately, it's unclear exactly what colors the Vikings wore. We have proof of red, blue, and yellow dyes, which could also be used to make green and purple. Mannering says, but researchers aren't sure how commonly used each was and how they were sourced. some unearthed textiles no longer carry traces of dye, which complicates the mystery. And while some portrayals give the impression that the Viking population rejected baths, evidence shows that they likely prioritized hygiene. Archaeologists have uncovered artifacts like combs, razors, tweezers, and ear spoons to clean earwax. The Vikings also concocted an early form of shampoo. According to both written records and archaeological finds, Vikings were big on accessories. Many wore belts equipped with handy tools for either expeditions or farming. They were also keen on bling, sporting necklaces and arm rings made of wood, glass, and gold. In their burials, well-traveled Vikings made sure to flaunt jewelry brought from places like North Africa, the Middle East, and India. Invasive eats. These 9 plants and animals cause billions of dollars of damage in the U.S. Luckily for the eco-minded, they're also delicious. Gathered in a vineyard near Wren, Oregon, hungry guests eyed a buffet littered with culinary oddities. Wild nettle crescent buns featuring mustard blossom butter. Fennel blackberry gelato. French-style ale brewed with the wildflower Queen Anne's lace. Welcome to the Institute for Applied Ecology's annual Invasive Species Cook-Off. Andrew Esterson, the Institute's Habitat Restoration Program Director, served up his tried-and-true chili verde, but sidelined the traditional pork for something less expected. Swamp rat, a semi-aquatic rodent also known as nutria or koipu. The meat was actually lovely. It was this dark purple color, Esterson says of the novel protein. If you add enough spices and peppers to anything, it's probably going to taste pretty good. And it turned out to be delicious. Delicious enough, in fact, to win first place in the savory meat category of the 2018 competition. But nutria, along with every other dish at the cook-off, shouldn't be here, geographically speaking. Native to South America, the rodents were introduced to North America by fur farmers in the 20th century. By the time the international fur market collapsed in the 1980s, nutria had gained a reputation as insatiable pests, burrowing into irrigation structures, spreading disease, and destroying the eggs and nests of water birds. They aren't alone. Today, tens of thousands of non-native species thrive in U.S. lands and waters. Of those, nearly 6,500 are considered invasive, meaning they cause ecological or economic harm as they spread. These invaders, which often lack natural predators to keep them in check, wreak more environmental, health-related, and financial damage each year than all other natural disasters combined. And it's likely to get worse. As regions everywhere become warmer due to our changing climate, they become more hospitable to invasive species, while expanding global trade perpetuates their spread. This daunting eco-challenge has sparked a culinary revolution. Transform non-native plants and animals into something delicious and add them to our menus. The movement could put a dent in invasive populations while inventing some fun new meals, too. Plenty of restaurants, food suppliers, and adventurous eaters have heeded the call and shared some suggestions to get you started. 1. Garden snail. The brown garden snail is native to the Mediterranean region and Western Europe. Now, however, the mollusk is one of the most widely spread land snails in the world and considered invasive in parts of the U.S. and Canada. In many cases, the living escargot was deliberately imported from Europe for food and farming, and for the occasional hobbyist's snail collection. French immigrants, for example, introduced the snail to California as food during the 1850s. Just a half century later, many Californians deemed the brown garden snail a pest in citrus orchards. It's also a major threat to vineyards, garden flowers, grain, and other agricultural industry sectors. To combat them, farmers turn to pruning, poison, and even the predatory decollete snail, which carries the risk of introducing further harm to an ecosystem. Try it yourself. In the southeast U.S. or along the west and east coasts, grab a cloth bag for an evening or morning stroll through your yard. Snails found in the fall are thought to be the tastiest, but they're also abundant in the spring, Just rinse them and boil for a few minutes to access the meat. 2. Kudzu. Kudzu hails from Asia but was introduced to the U.S. as an ornamental plant at the 1876 Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia. For most of the next century, farmers cultivated the leafy vine en masse to feed livestock and reduce soil erosion. Government agencies even funded the effort and provided over 85 million seedlings, while danger lurked in their aggressive growth rate. Kudzu quashes native plant species, even entire trees, by smothering them from sunlight. Growing at a rate of 1 foot per day, it didn't take long for the killer vine to outgrow the farmland where it was first cultivated. Although it's known as the vine that ate the South, the species has so far been reported in forests across 31 states, as far north as New York and as far west as Hawaii, according to a mapping system developed by the University of Georgia. Try it yourself. For thousands of years, people hailing from Eastern and Southeastern Asia have consumed its roots, which make up 40% of the total plant, as a staple food and herbal medicine today called longevity powder or Asian ginseng. So long as they haven't come into contact with herbicides, toss the leaves into a soup or salad, pickle the grape-scented purple flowers, or transform them into jellies and syrups, or use the starchy roots as a gluten-free alternative to wheat flour in your favorite soup. 3. Wild boar. Wild boars are native to Eurasia, but can now be found on every continent except Antarctica. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says the boar was introduced to the states in the early 1900s for private hunting. Similarly, domestic pigs were introduced by settlers as a food source in the 1500s. Today, feral swine are typically hybrids of these Eurasian wild boars and pigs that have escaped captivity. The population, which is most concentrated across California and the southern U.S., is now estimated to exceed 6 million. Just keep in mind that this is not your typical pig. The tusked and pernicious porkers are responsible for over $1.5 billion in annual damage to U.S. grassland and forest ecosystem and crops, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They can also host a huge variety of viruses, bacteria, and parasites. Try it yourself. If you aren't much of a hunter, plenty of brick-and-mortar and online shops offer wild boar meat, said to be more delicious than domestic pork due to its leaner body. Or try it in ragu or headlining a barbecue slider. 4. Lionfish. Scattered from Brazil to New York without any natural predators or parasites, lionfish populations reach concentrations 5 to 15 times higher than in their native waters of the South Pacific and Indian Oceans. En masse, they can obliterate communities of native fish. Rumors persist that the invasion began with a shattered aquarium during Hurricane Andrew in 1992, but evidence suggests that they were introduced no later than 1985 at a site along Dania Beach, Florida. Today, hunting lionfish has become a recreation of sorts. The International Reef Environmental Education Foundation has hosted annual lionfish derbies since 2010, awarding prizes to those who spear the largest and smallest fish and the greatest quantity while diving and snorkeling. Top catches have measured in just over 18 inches. And ever since the Seafood Watch Sustainability Program gave a green light for consumption in 2016, grocery stores like Whole Foods have offered tasty lionfish fillets to their customers. Try it yourself. Conservation biologist Joe Roman describes lionfish as a gateway species for anyone curious about eating invasives. Its firm, white meat is reminiscent of grouper, with a mild, buttery flavor. And you prepare it just like any other fish. After a fishmonger removes its venomous spines, the venom can stay active after the fish dies, so handle with caution. Grill it, stew it, bake it in breadcrumbs, or roll it into a roulade. 5. American bullfrog. The American bullfrog is found natively in the lands, ponds, and wetlands of eastern North America. To the west of the Rockies, as well as parts of Central and South America, Western Europe, and Asia, the species is considered invasive. There, the bullfrog ambushes and eats anything that will fit in its mouth. Insects, crustaceans, fishes, birds, reptiles, even other amphibians. Frog legs were commonly eaten in southern China as early as the 1st century AD. On the other side of the world, the Aztecs partook as well. In Europe, the first mention of the food comes from the Catholic Church in 12th century France, when hungry monks abstaining from meat categorized the amphibian as a fish. Nowadays, its invasion into more than 50 countries can be attributed to the international frog trade and the practice of frog farming. The U.S. and European Union are some of the largest importers. It's a big issue, mainly because the frog is also a vector for the curtid fungus, implicated in the extinction of nearly 100 other frog species. Try it yourself. If you're seeking a leg to nibble on, experts recommend against buying farmed or native frog. Seek out a stream or swamp where bullfrogs are invasive. Back in your kitchen, add the meat to a wok with teriyaki sauce and vegetables, or dredge it in beer batter and deep fry it Cajun style. 6. Green iguana. The green iguana is native to Central and South America and parts of the Caribbean, but the pet trade is to blame for its invasion of Florida, Texas, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands towards the turn of the 21st century. Young green iguanas are commonly purchased as pets due to their small size, affordable price tag, and low cost of maintenance. But the cute critters don't stay small forever. They can grow up to 6 feet in length and quickly outgrow the homes that once wanted them. Turned loose and now running rampant and reproducing by the thousands in South Florida, the green iguana devours landscaping and digs burrows that degrade sidewalks, canals, and seawalls. Although primarily herbivores, they also threaten endangered species such as tree snails and the Miami blue butterfly. In Puerto Rico, populations have been known to take over sunny airport runways and cause flight delays, or, in worse circumstances, damage aircrafts. Try it yourself. Eating iguana is nothing new. Communities in South and Central America have eaten the native chicken of the trees since pre-colonial times. In Florida, no hunting license or permit is needed for capturing and killing the lizard. If you're hankering for a taste, skin the iguana or dip it in hot water to scrape off its scales. Then boil in salt water for half an hour before roasting or stewing to your heart's desire. If you're already itching to purchase some lionfish fillets, remember that the goal is not to get hooked permanently on a new cuisine, says Martin Nunez, an ecologist at the University of Houston. He warns that a rise in demand could generate market pressure to maintain a species or even spread it to other regions. If customers keep this in mind, some species, looking at you dandelions, will likely never be eaten to total extinction. Yet functional eradication, or limiting invasives to levels that cause the least ecological harm, is feasible with a little public outreach, says conservation biologist Joe Roman, founder of the educational website Eat the Invaders. He suggests newcomers to the invasivore movement forage for native and non-native species in their own backyards before exploring supermarket aisles. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.